Lord Christ. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be always pleasing in thy sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. I don't know who remembers Denny Crane from Boston Legal. I don't know if anybody watched Boston Legal. It was a cult television show produced by David Kelly. So think Twin Peaks from the early 80s. And Boston Legal was in the mid to late 90s. And it's centered around a law firm in Boston, Crane, Poole, and Schmidt. And at the center was Denny Crane, played fabulously by William Shatner. And Shatner was this legendary trial lawyer who was suffering from Alzheimer's or dementia. He called it mad cow disease. And as this cruel disease began to overtake this big, powerful lawyer more, he would hang on to his name anymore. His name was feared in the legal circles. And so he would go into a courtroom, and you can sort of picture like a Williams Jennings Bryant sort of look, and he would just look at the jurors and the judges and the opposing counsel, and he would just say, Denny Crane, Denny Crane. I wish I could do a better William Shatner, but you get it. If you like Shatner, he'd just go, Denny Crane, and say it like you mean it, and he would just go on and on, and that's all he could do. Now, that's sort of humorous, especially if you saw the show. If you didn't, you're like, wow, that's weird. But if you saw the show, you would know that there's a real power in the name. Well, you don't have to see a show to know there's powers in names. The commander-in-chief, doctor, lawyer, your honor, your excellency, reverend. You know, there's a connotation, in other words, with everybody, Mr., Mrs., Ms., Professor, you go on and on. Grandma, Mimi, go on and on. Names carry with them the offices that many of them hold, whether it's a vocational office like a minister or a family office, such as being a grandparent or being a mom or a dad or a brother or sister, etc. They carry all these baggages, though, good and bad, right? Every name has a long litany of things that are sort of attached to it, unspoken, but they're still attached. And they have such a powerful location to sort of tell you who it is, right? Musician, I mean, you name it, right? Just start thinking about the way when you say somebody's name, you may attach, well, they are a great writer. So all the things that come up behind that just sort of are instantly there and assumed. And it's no different than in the time of Jesus. No different in the time of any humanity. But in today, in the gospel that we read, we get Jesus punching through to say, who am I? Who do people say that I am? Now, you get the little wide range of answers, and that's where you see the Elijah or John the Baptist, and you see this idea of the prophets. So in other words, there's probably some sense that there's been a discussion amongst the disciples about how do we categorize this new teacher? What name, because that's another thing a name gives us, is an ability to control or to categorize or to put somebody in a bucket. They are so-and-so, fill in the blank. They're an extrovert, so you know they're just going to talk all the time. They're an introvert, so they know they just want to read, right? Or however, I mean, it's a pretty black and white examples, but you get my point. So Jesus is saying, who am I? He's asking them, who am I? He's been teaching and preaching with them for a good while now, right? Performing miracles. And so they must have some idea of who they are. And so they sort of bounce around. And then Peter, our greatest interlocutor in the New Testament, right, says, you are the Messiah. That's the Christ. Wow, he nails it. Peter sometimes nails it out of the gate, and then we'll see what happens in a second. But anyway, he nails it. Now, by way of reminder, the Messiah is a very loaded term in this time in history. It indicates the anticipated deliverer of Israel, the restoration of the throne of God's people. It's something they've longed for. They've been waiting for. It's something that has been deeply hardened into their psyches is that little kernel of hope that they've just been crammed. What's going to throw, what's going to take down the Roman Empire? What's going to restore God's people to the righteous place, to the right place? It's going to be this Messiah. We've been longing for it for years and years. The restoration, in other words, is all of a sudden all thrusted onto Jesus by Peter's statement that you are the Messiah and Jesus' acceptance that he is that. He's strong then, right? Because that's what comes along with that connotation. He's got military might. He's ready to overthrow the other, the Roman Empire. Now, you can't find a definition of the Messiah that doesn't say restoration or overthrow. It is all about geopolitical military power. In other words, it's right-handed power. Right-handed power is straight line power. It's accumulation. It's worldly power. It's a military and political idea that we can gather and collect more pieces on our side than they have on their side. It's bringing either armies or voters into our corner to show that we have the strength and the force. Think about that classic game, Risk. Who played Risk? I love Risk, right? And you win by controlling your opponent, making them make a decision. How many times did you play Risk and somebody had to say, oh, I got to move here. And you knew you had them trapped, right? That's right-handed power. It's accumulation. And it's like getting your 963 bulldozer and head right towards them. That was for you, Dan Beasley. this sort of idea of control and accumulation is part and parcel to the idea of the Messiah. So you can picture then all of a sudden they're arriving in town and the seekers out in the disciples. This guy's the Messiah. So I wonder how quickly they were like, when's he going to bring the big guns? You know, when is this going to really kick into place? They must have been excited. And then we hear that Jesus begins to talk openly. Okay, that line, talk openly, is so important because basically he goes to the center of Caesarea Philippi and he's shouting from the rooftops. What's he shouting from the rooftops? Not about military or geopolitical might. But he says that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the powers, be rejected by the chief priests and the elders and the scribes, and then finally be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. Imagine the cognitive dissonance that must have flowed through the disciples. That one minute, they thought Jesus was going to show up in a big bulldozer and plow over the Roman Empire. And now he's right in the middle of town saying, my job here is to go undergo suffering and to ultimately die after you reject me. So you got to love Peter's instincts if you didn't get that. He's got to be totally horrified. Maybe he's like, this Messiah just didn't read the Messiah memo. And so he doesn't know what's going on. And so let's pull aside the boss. You notice that it says, Peter pulled Jesus aside and said, come on, buddy. You don't know that the Messiah is the power figure. He is going to take over. I mean, this is, you are sort of Zeus. You're the big man on campus, in other words. And what does Jesus do? He minces no words. And he opens up the striking difference between the way of man and the way of God. He calls Peter Satan. Did you notice that? He says, get behind me, Satan. In other words, he's saying, Peter, you're only focused on what the world can give you. Your understanding of the Messiah, and then, in other words, is rooted in this idea of worldly things. And that's not what I'm here to talk about. I'm here to focus on godly things. In other words, Jesus is telling Peter that the way of the world is over and against God. Because God's ways are opposite the ways of the world. And this is the absolute best news we could ever find. Because it means that in God's economy, it's not about straight line power. It's not about accumulation. It's not about how fast can we go forward? What can we build? No, it's not about geopolitical power. No, it's not about using control over another. It's not about right-handed power, which uses numbers or size or notoriety or accomplishment as its scorecard. No, it's about left-handed power. Left-handed power is rooted in sacrifice and love and acceptance and mercy and forgiveness. These are the hallmarks of God's kingdom. And this is the good news of the gospel. Well, why is it so important? It's so important because we're talking about God's power, like the way God wants to work in the world. What it means when we say the name God, what are we talking about? We're talking about love, mercy, forgiveness, humility, graciousness, the opposite of the way that the world thinks. In other words, God's power looks like weakness. It looks ordinary. And many times it's hidden, even in plain sight. So, funny little thought experiment, which you could do with any year, but it's just a great little illustration of right and left-handed power. So, if there was a 24-hour news cycle in 1809, the year would have been dominated by Napoleon's invasion, the French invasion of Austria, the Battle of Austria, which took place basically that whole year. Now, how many people in this room can give me, can give us a litany of how that battle unfolded? Maybe there's a couple PhDs, I'm sure somewhere in the world, that have mastered that whole year, but you get my point. But yet, how many people in this room have heard of Lord Tennyson? Or Oliver Wendell Holmes, Edgar Allan Poe, Charles Darwin, Abraham Lincoln. The same year that all the news cycle, the Today Show would have been live from Austria every day that year. All those names I just mentioned were born that year. They were born that year. So this thought experiment, what's it tell you? Is that 2,000 years ago, people would have been fixated on the military might, on Caesar, on what the Roman Empire was going to do. And yet, in that little crash in Bethlehem, there was a little baby born to an unwed teenage mom and her fiance. Left-handed power appears when we least expect it. Left-handed power appears when we least expect it. Luther says that left-handed power is the most powerful force in the world because we don't expect it, and you can't take it away. It's not based on accumulation. It's based on giving up. You can't take something away from somebody if they're like, here. They're like, you want more? Okay, fine, take this. Take this. You want to hit this cheek? That's fine. Hit this cheek. You can't do anything about it, in other words. God works through left-handed power. There's a clear and incredibly powerful illustration of this, and the power that it has in individuals' lives. 20 years ago, in a day, we all remember where we were. We all remember the sounds, the phone calls. Who'd you call first? Were you watching the TV? Where were you when the second plane hit the tower, the South Tower? Where were you when you heard reports of the plane over Pennsylvania? Where were you at 7 p.m. that evening when the whole country went out with candlelights to gather together? And it wasn't just our country, but it was the whole world. We all very much remember that day, a day that was marked in one regard by evil forces using right-handed power to hurt other people, to attack, to try to take things away. But like all right-handed power moves, there's always the left-handed power response. There is always something hidden. There is always something at work in the shadows, in the rubble, in the destruction, both metaphoric and real. It's always present. And it always saves lives, one person at a time. What I'm thinking about is the story of Wells Crowther. Some of you all may have heard of this. Wells grew up in Nyack, New York. His dad volunteered at the firehouse, and as soon as Wells was old enough, he too hung around the firehouse. He had a family of five, and they loved church, and he loved sports, and he was, by all accounts, just a really happy-go-lucky kid that definitely loved his pop, as he called him. And one week, while they were dressing up to go to church, he's still dressed up, Wells' dad put his little white handkerchief in his blazer pocket. And his dad, his dad, Jeff Crowther, handed his son his own handkerchief because Wells said, "I want one of those." And he handed him a white handkerchief and a red bandana, one for show and one for the blows or blow. And many of you all carried probably handkerchiefs and a pocket square at the same time. So Wells kept this red bandana. It was just sort of his signature connection with his dad throughout all of his years of playing sports and lacrosse and ice hockey. He excelled on the field and on the ice, ended up playing Division I lacrosse at Boston College. And after college, he got a job at Sandler O'Neill, which is an investment firm based in Atlanta and New York, the whole time wearing his suit with his breast pocket, white hanky, and his red bandana in his back pocket. Now, Sandler O'Neill's office was in the World Trade Center complex. They were spread out throughout that area. And right after the explosion on the first plane, the North Tower, Wells called his mom at 8:50 a.m. and said, "I'm okay." 8:50 a.m., 4 minutes or so after that first plane had hit. Just pause with that. You can flash forward about 3 to 4 years later, and the New York Times has been compiling stories of survivors of the 9/11 attack that were in the towers, in particularly the South Tower, where the wing severed into the side of the building. And some people made it out, and many, many obviously did not, right between the 70th floor and the 86th floor. So they tried to hunt down all the people that had survived. How did you get out? What was that like? Just trying to get their stories. And in these stories, the three reporters that had just tried to track everybody down across the country that had made it out, they began to see a singular detail. People began to talk about meeting a man with a red bandana. All of a sudden, different people from around the country said, "I was laying on the ground and I heard a man's call out to me. The stairs are over here." And I looked up and he had a red bandana over his face. And then he would lead us to the stairs, and then he would disappear back into the smoke and the dust and the debris of the floor. He kept showing up, one person right. And I would hear this man shout again, "If you're over here, follow me." And he would get us into the stairwell, and then he would disappear again. We can guess who that man was. At last count, Wells Crowther brought at least 18 people to safety from the 70th floor down to the 60th floor, where there was a bank of working elevators. They found Wells' body a few years later, and repaired in the rubble. Sitting with that is not to encourage us to all go out and be Wells Crowthers. His dad even said in an interview, "You know, I sure wish I could take his place, and yet I don't think I would have been able to do what he did." It's not the moral of this sermon to go out and find your own red bandana. But what Wells does illustrate for us is the way that God works in our lives. Is that God works through pure sacrifice, pure love, pure self-emptying of self, in the midst of our rubble. The rubble on that day in 9/11 was the Twin Towers. But we all know that we have rubble in our own lives, places of fissures and cracks and hurts, places where we need someone to shout out to us, come here. Here is safety. And that's precisely the good news, is that when Jesus went to the cross, he went there for Wells and for all of us, giving up his life so that we might have life, so that we might know that we are safe and loved by God. There's nothing we can do about that. Amen.
Please stand as we reaffirm our faith. Read the Nicene Creed.